Yeah, everyone's asleep. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting edition slash episode slash chronicle of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live, internationally syndicated on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and also rebroadcasts for those of you in Hamilton on Rush 87.7 in Hamilton, and in the Southland area we have the iFinity FM network at ifinityfm.co.nz. Thank you all very much for listening. Today we have, I guess I've been in this movement for a number of years, but this man, out of all the hundreds, if not thousands of people that I've spoken to, both on air and off, be they listeners or guests, is by far one of my favourites. His name's Max Egan, and he's so gargantuan in Australia and now throughout the world because of his unique perspective on things and how he allows people to come to their own conclusions and develop their own understandings about the nature of reality itself, which is very rarely questioned in any classroom you'd ever see. Max Egan from thecrowhouse.com. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on, Vinny, and thank you for such a wonderful introduction. That's very kind of you to say those wonderful things. It's an honour that you would think those things, and it's an honour to be on your show, brother.
Well, we have only 2 hours, and it'll go by fairly quick. The reason why we brought you on today, Max, is to elucidate on your recent world tour where you've gone to Palestine and the UK, and surely goodness knows there are other things. I haven't been keeping that much abreast in front of it, and I'm just curious to get a bit of a catch up, bro.
Well, yeah, it was a it was a very interesting trip. Started off in Peru, went from Peru up to Costa Rica, from Costa Rica went over to Spain and down to Portugal. Spent a few days in an intentional community in southern Portugal called Temera, and went from there basically to Slovenia and spoke at the World Hemp Congress, the first ever World Hemp Congress, which was pretty amazing that a government would even have such a thing. That was kind of interesting. I went from there to England, did a lot of stuff there, was staying with Ken O'Keefe, who I'm sure many people know of. Ken O'Keefe was on the Mavi Marmara. He was part of the Iraqi Shield operation, the human shield operation that happened in Iraq when Bush invaded Iraq. Spent a bit of time with him, went over to Ireland, went and saw Dave Icke while I was over there. It was all quite quite good. Caught up with Rick Simpson in Slovenia at the World Hemp Congress as well. Actually went and stayed with Rick in Croatia for a couple of weeks after the whole thing was done, just before I came home. But while I was in England staying with Ken, We went to Gaza, which was really the highlight of the trip for me. I mean, the whole thing was amazing, but going to Gaza was almost surreal to be in this place that, I mean, ever since I was a kid on TV, I've heard about the Gaza Strip. It's always been in the news. It's like this place where terrorists live and terrible things happen, you know, the Gaza Strip.
Is it anything like the Las Vegas Strip?
No, very, very different to the Las Vegas Strip, my brother. But it was amazing. It was surreal being there. And I just kind of, Ken and I did it off the cuff, you know. We thought, you know, we were pretty bold, really, and we kind of snuck in there and kind of got escorted out in a nice way. They were very kind to us, but they did kind of make sure that we left when we said we were leaving and that all this sort of stuff was taken care of. We got detained at the border on the way out by Hamas and all that sort of stuff. They were very nice to us. They were very kind, considering we had kind of snuck into their country. But we did a lot of good stuff while we were in there. We built a schoolroom for some children while we were in there. We went and did some radio spots. We did a spot on Press TV. We spoke at the university. We made a couple of videos and posted them on YouTube. So we didn't make a secret that we were in there because we figured, well, they probably know we're here anyway. You can't really get Ken O'Keefe into Gaza without people noticing. And so, yeah, we figured we'd better make a video and let them know where we were and let them know that we're here. You know, we kind of did the video on the roof of the building so people could see exactly where we were. And sure enough, they came to see us. They sort of gave us a bit of a slap on the wrist and basically held our passports until the day we left and then gave them back to us, and we left. They kind of escorted us out. And yeah, it was good experience. But the feel of the people in Gaza was the important part of the whole thing. I mean, just getting to meet these people and see them on their own level and see what it's like to be living in the Gaza Strip. They were very surprised, actually, that there were no air raids and no rocket attacks. There was actually only one rocket hit while we were there. And this is a thing also that people have to understand what goes on over there as far as breaking the ceasefire and things go. You've got to understand that Israel shoots rockets into Gaza all the time. They shoot fishermen all the time. Israel breaks the ceasefire all the time. Anyone gets close to the buffer zone, which is Palestinian land, you know, they walk. If they get close to the fence, they get shot. But while they're still in Palestinian land, so it isn't like when Hamas starts shooting a few pipes over the fence that they've broken the ceasefire, because Israel breaks it all the time. We were there and we heard a rocket hit in the northern suburbs of Gaza while we were there. About three people died, I think, that morning. And there was no response to that. You know, Palestine didn't respond. While we were there, one morning I got woken up to the sound of machine gun fire, and it was Israeli gunboats out on the in the ocean shooting at the fishermen. And they shot two brothers that morning. One of them died. And they shot another guy a couple of days later out there. And these are guys that are fishing within the 3 nautical mile zone. So, you know, this ceasefire gets broken all the time. So that was the reality of life in Gaza. And children, just children everywhere, so many children. The place is full of children. Over half the population is children. And that's the thing, you know, they're attacking this population. They're raining bombs down on these people. But there's 1.6 million people in the Gaza Strip, and over 800,000 of them are children. And of the adults, half of them are women. So there's around about 1.2 million women and children out of the population of 1.6 million. And they drop bombs on this and they go to battle against this and they call it a war. You've got the most powerful military nation on earth, Israel, battling against this population mainly of women and children who have no navy, no army, no air force, no ordnance, no artillery, no tanks, no jeeps, no RVs, no nothing. Nothing. They got handmade fertilizer powered rockets that don't explode when they hit the ground. It just lumps a pipe that comes smashing through your roof, you know. You know, it's ridiculous to be able to battle against these people and have the nerve to call it a war. It's not a war. It's a genocide against a prison population, a besieged population, an impoverished population consisting mainly of women and children. And the people that I met there were beautiful. They were some of the nicest and most kindest and beautiful, most friendly people I'd ever met. Any person you stopped to, you could go to a store to buy a tool or a piece of wood or a desk or a newspaper, anything. As soon as you start stopping and talking to the shopkeeper, as soon as you start having a bit of a conversation with him, they go and get a tray of tea and they want to sit down, they get a couple of chairs, they want to sit down and have tea with you, maybe get some falafel and have a big social gathering, get all their friends and talk to you. Everybody's so friendly and so hospitable and so willing to talk to you about any issue, and they're very, very informed on everything, you know.
That's what I've found when Westerners go to Gaza in particular. They love them because they hope in some way, shape, or form, that Westerner will be able to get it out to the Western media what's happening there.
Well, that's what I tried to do. I actually released a film 10 days ago, a short 15-minute film called 10 Days in Gaza. Max Egan and Ken O'Keefe, 10 Days in Gaza. And what I did in that was just try to show the real side of the people there. And I interviewed some university students, and they're all saying, look, I'm learning English because it's a global language, and that way when I talk, everyone will understand me, and I'll be able to tell the world that we in Palestine just want to be like everybody else in the world. You know, we're not terrorists. We're real people, and we just want to be like you guys. We just want to be able to be a nation and be accepted and be able to travel. I mean, we're trapped here. You know, that's the thing with the people in Gaza. They have no voice because, oh, they're just terrorists. You can't believe what they say. It's a terror zone. We've had to besiege it because it's full of terrorists. It's not. This is one of the last places of Palestine that's left. And you know how the story goes. I mean, you look at what Israel's done to take all of the country and turn the whole of the country into Israel, I mean, even if you look at the 1948 petition, the UN petition, when they divided Palestine, they made basically most of it Israel, but they left large areas there in the west and in the east for Palestine, all along Gaza and all through the West Bank and up the north. That was all there for the Palestinian people. And since then, Israel has taken it all. There's virtually none of Palestine left. And anybody who stands up against their continual theft of land, they call it terrorist. You know, it's a complete scam. But what you're seeing with the Palestinian people is a dispossessed race of people. These are surplus human beings that are being warehoused. And Israel is presenting a working model to the world how you can warehouse surplus human beings. And as if this is just the norm, this is just the way it should be. This is just the way you treat these people. And these are people who don't have a nationality. They can't get a passport because there is no Palestinian nationality. It's the same in Israel. You know, there is no Israeli nationality. Did you know that? There's Israeli citizenship, but there isn't Israeli nationality. So if you're a Palestinian living within Israel, which is a lot of them are, because, I mean, Israel's annexed virtually all of Palestine. So, I mean, all the Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, which is controlled by Israel, these people don't have a nation because they're Israeli citizens, but you can only be of Jewish nationality. There's a law they brought in, the law of return, which states that the nationality of an Israeli is a Jewish nationality. And if you're of Jewish nationality, you have all the rights that you should have as a human being. But if you're not of Jewish nationality, you don't have any rights. You can be an Israeli citizen, but you have no nationality because there is no Israeli nationality. Even the Supreme Court doesn't recognize an Israeli nationality because if they did, there would be no Jewish supremacism system. It wouldn't function. It couldn't function if there was an Israeli nationality. So that's how they've done it.
I want to know, this is funny. I mean, when they say Jewish nationality, are they talking about you have to be descended from one of the tribes, or do you just have to be a practicing Jew, you know, going to the synagogue, celebrating Yom Kippur, what have you, and is that it? Or
no, it's the way Israel's got it set up. It's nothing to do with Jews everywhere or anything like that. It's the law of return that's been brought in Israel. If you return to Israel, because they're calling all Jews back to Israel, right? So if you, as a Jew, return to Israel and you gain Israeli citizenship, you have then you have the Jewish nationality. You need Israeli citizenship to have Jewish nationality. You seeing what I'm saying?
Which means you have to pledge your allegiance to the Zionist regime in Israel in order to have a Jewish identity from Zionist regime.
Not really. I mean, if you're a Jew, doesn't matter where you are in the world, you go and you return to Israel, there's a law of return. As soon as you return, you've got full rights, full political rights as a Jew. As soon as you return to Israel, the day you return and become a Jewish citizen, you've got full, an Israeli citizen, you've got full nationality rights as a Jewish nationality. But that means if you're a Palestinian living within
you?
Normal rights that you have as a normal human being. Oh. Normal rights, normal grants to a legal system, the rights that we enjoy as free democratic societies, right?
But if you're an Israeli, which people could have anywhere else.
Exactly. But if you are a Palestinian living within Israel, right, you can't be of Jewish nationality because you're a Palestinian, so therefore you have no rights. Mm-hmm. You're only an Israeli citizen, but citizens don't get rights. Only nationals get rights. You see, this is the law of return. This is an apartheid law that's been brought in. This has been institutionalized. This has been legalized by this law to purposely make Palestinians living within this territory second-class citizens.
Second-class citizens.
Absolutely. And see, a lot of people, Israelis and Jews and stuff, they don't have no idea that this is in place. So you can't really be down on the population. They just think, oh, these Palestinians, they just complain all the time. But they don't realize that the Palestinians have no rights that you would grant normal human beings, not under the Israeli system, because of the two distinctions between Israeli citizenship and Jewish nationality that goes with Israeli citizenship. You see what I'm saying?
I always thought one of the benefits of being an Israeli citizen is having access to cheap surplus white phosphorus.
Well, there's that. But you've got to understand, I mean, this is a trick that's been played against the Jewish people as well, because they don't understand why there's this whole thing going on with the Palestinians, why they can't just be at peace, right? They don't understand what the Palestinians have to go through every day just to live in this area, which used to be their country. I mean, it was their country 100 years ago. In 1948, they still had half of it. And now the pockets that are left are totally either under siege, as in the Gaza Strip, or utterly controlled by Israelis, as in the West Bank. In the West Bank, which is an area the size of, say, Sydney Western Suburbs, you've got 500 Israeli checkpoints. You know, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. So you can't do anything in the West Bank. And not only that, you don't have the normal rights of a national, because you're not a Jewish national. You're only an Israeli citizen. You know?
It's like being in a perpetual line for an amusement park, but without the amusement. That's Gaza for you, ladies and gentlemen. Take a ride. We'll be right back after the break with Max Egan from thecrowhouse.com. You can listen in live in the chat room at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, and there's also iPhone and Android apps downloadable from americanfreedomradio.com. Get the word out, and we'll be right back after these messages. It down. Yes, cut a rug, baby. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. The booking is 2 hours in talk radio. It's on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week, and the archives are all freely available at theVinnieEastwoodShow.com and AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And I hope that you take the opportunity to peruse the long list of incredible guests and scumbaggery exposing individuals that we have on this show. There's usually a different person every day who'll teach you something you didn't already know. And I figured that's the way I like to live my life. I don't like doing the same thing all day, every day. Frack that. There's a heck of a lot of different things going on. Several billion people on the planet, several hundred countries, umpteen different languages. Why would I want to just focus on the one? Seems rather silly to me. Max Egan from thecrowhouse.com is my very special guest. And we were talking over the break about, I figured Max, you seem to have a focus on this Gaza thing because it was the most intense experience for you out of all of the places that you went to, just to see the condition that they're living in. Is that about right?
Well, it was the condition that they're living in, but it was also the quality of the people, like really, really quality people. You don't see this quality of human being every day in everywhere you go. They're beautiful people. And a lot of it is probably because they've been so downtrodden. But also, when I got to understand how it all works and how, like I was talking about before with the law of return and all this sort of stuff that's been imposed, this apartheid system and this warehousing of surplus human beings. And then I get back here and I start seeing things like, the carbon tax has come in here and suddenly everybody's electricity bill is now 3 or 4 times what it was last year. You've got people here that are virtually unable to meet the bills. And you're going to see if this continues in this curve that it's taking, I mean, wages aren't going up with this climb in costs. So you're seeing people being surplused all through the world. And what Israel has presented is a workable model. If you look at Gaza and the West Bank, you've got a workable model for surplusing human beings. And if we allow the corporate system to continue the way it is, what you'll find is a larger version of Israel and Palestine over the whole globe. You'll find that part of the world is Israel and the other part is Gaza. And that's where we're heading. And the part that is controlled by the elite will be Israel and the other part will be Gaza. That's where every country is heading. If we don't pay attention to this, you know, it's a microcosm of the macrocosm. If we allow this country of Palestine to simply be eaten up, by this entity that's created itself there, we're allowing a workable model for the rest of the world. And that's what really struck home to me. And even having gone and done ceremony in Peru and seeing the connection that we could actually have to the earth, I mean, it was profound, some of the things that I experienced in ceremony in Peru were absolutely incredible. A lot of my higher senses came online, and I felt the connection that we actually could have to the planet and the way we would be if we were actually left to our own devices. We wouldn't be in a civilization like this at all, especially not one that was economically based. And then to go through the whole trip and have it culminate in the Gaza Strip, here I am in this place that is surreal. And in there, it's almost like the last vestige of really, really pure people, you know. Our society has really corrupted a lot of human consciousness and a lot of people. It's corrupted the whole human spirit in what it's done by enslaving us to commerce. We've lost that real connection to each other. But the people in Gaza are all really connected to each other. All the families are really close. All the friends are really close. They really, really care about each other. Again, maybe it's because they've grown up in this situation where they have to, because they only have themselves to depend upon. Maybe it's just bred that beauty in them. But again, that's what I saw there. And what I saw is the way the world's going if we don't pay attention. So it was a profound experience, yeah.
Mm. Well, it's in times of crisis that everybody's empathy suddenly just shoots up in it, you know. Communities suddenly come together after an earthquake, etc. And, you know, we'll see. There's a movie called Charlie Wilson's War, and I think it was Philip Seymour Hoffman gives a speech about a Zen master. Young boy gets given a horse by his parents for one of his birthdays, and everybody in the whole town goes, "Wow, that's a beautiful horse. Well, you're so lucky to have that." And the Zen master says, "We'll see." And then later on, the boy falls off his horse and he breaks his leg and he has to spend 3 months in a cast. And everybody said, "Oh, that's so terrible that he fell off his horse and broke his leg." And the Zen master says, "We'll see." And after that, the boy got better and everybody said, "Oh, isn't it great that he healed and there was no complications?" What does the Zen master say? "We'll see." That's kind of how everything does turn out. You don't know where it's heading exactly. But you do know that things change all the time. And a lot of things are very unpredictable. Especially human experience, human potential. And you see this thing popping up all the place. In the most extreme situations, the necessity of survival comes out. And I believe that maybe these Palestinian people are so close together out of sheer necessity, because they're all under threat from the outside. So it means that they band together so strongly as to eliminate any threat and scumbaggery from the inside to protect themselves.
Yeah, well, a lot of that as well, you know. But they're all very real. They're all very real people, and I don't see a terrorist situation in there at all. I simply see people that are standing up against the system and saying, "Enough is enough. You can't take any more from us," you know. And you know, the people that I met there, I mean, they should be recognized as people the way all people are. They should have the rights that are afforded to all people. And it's simply because, you know, they voted for a government that the West didn't particularly want in there. There's no reason to besiege them. And they didn't know what Hamas was going to be like. I mean, they just wanted change. I mean, the Gaza used to look like the West Bank. It could take six hours to get through a checkpoint in the West Bank. The Israelis dot every I and cross every T to get you through the checkpoint. You know, there's women there in labour, and the hospital's right within view, and they won't get through the checkpoint until all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. And the Israelis will let them give birth on the side of the road rather than let them through the checkpoint, you know, with the hospital right there. You know, pregnant women in labour. So this is the way life used to be in Gaza. And they said, "Enough is enough. We want freedom." So they voted for a government that promised to give them freedom and also promised them better health care and all the sorts of stuff the government promises them, you know. And so Hamas gets elected and suddenly they say, "Well, okay, well, now we're in power. We'll just close the election office. No more elections, thank you." because Fatah didn't want him elected. And we hear that, that Hamas violently seized power. But that's not true. What happened was the people voted for Hamas, and then Fatah tried to violently retain power, so Hamas had to violently seize power from these guys who wouldn't give it up. And that's kind of what happened. And then because they did that, Israel besieged the whole place, and suddenly we get what we've got now. I mean, you know, you could have given them a chance to just try to do something. And then just with this recent war, the guy they killed was a guy called Ahmed Jabari, and he was Jabari, yeah, something like that. And he was brokering a peace accord. He had a lasting truce and all of this stuff organized to bring about a lasting truce with Israel. And that's who Israel chose to assassinate, which is what started this whole last 8-day conflict. This was the guy who was trying to create peace. So, you know,
let me get this straight. Here's the real story. The guy who's brokering a peace deal between Israel and Palestine to bring them together and end this long, long conflict is assassinated by Israel today. And as a result, Israel gets really angry at the person and the people that they assassinated and enslaved and bombed them again. And this is how it's reported in the Western media through the Israeli media machine filtering process. Terrorist, dangerous Palestinians shot weapons of mass destruction, killing one Israeli. And it responds to defend itself as it knows how and does best and kills 1,000 women and children. Good on you, well, Israel. Aren't you fighting fit?
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, they shot this guy. I mean, out of all the people to take out, he was the most moderate of all of Hamas. He was the head of Hamas military. He was the most moderate of all of them, and he was in the final processes of drafting a lasting truce, which would have brought about total control of everything. Any extremist groups like Islamic Jihad that might fire something over into Israel, Hamas, we're going to be straight on them, take care of that, not a problem. Anybody fires, we'll get them. We want peace. You know, so they shot him. Bang, took him out, killed him and his 14-year-old son and a 13-year-old kid nearby. And then so Hamas responds by shooting 110 rockets over into Israel, into Palestinian land occupied by Israel anyway. And they're just rockets. I mean, they're just like skyrockets. They just go up and then they fall down. They don't explode. You know, one guy was saying how terrified he was because he had a Hamas rocket went through the back window of his car. You know, the three Israelis who died from heart attacks. And as a response, Israel just carpet bombs Gaza, kills 21 members of one family with one bomb, taking out kids and children. And of course, you can't help but target women and children when you bomb Gaza, because 1.2 million people are women and children. You know, there's about 400,000 men, the rest of them are women and children. So, of course, that's who you're waging war against, you know. And they started it by taking out the guy who was drafting the peace accord, because they don't want peace. They want to control all the land. They don't want anyone to get in the way of their model of surplusing human beings and warehousing human beings, which is what they're doing. And that's why I found it so important for people to pay attention to this issue. And also because of the friends I met there, Vinny. Man, if I'd met you there, Vinny, and you had no voice to tell the people of the world that hey, you're not a terrorist, you're a real person, and I'd got to know you and suddenly come back here, I'd feel obligated to speak out about what's going on in New Zealand and how to, you know, you got to get my friend Vinny here, he's being bombed, he's a good guy, he's not a terrorist, you know what I'm saying? These are nice people, and I made a real connection with them, and they have no voice. And that's why I released that clip that I was talking about, 10 days in Gaza, just to show people that these are real people. You don't have to be concerned that they're going to come and blow you up with a suitcase. They're not. They're just real people. They just want to be recognized as real people. They don't want any war. They don't want any conflict. They just want a normal life like everybody else. So, you know, the whole thing is it's a stage, mate. It's a stage. It's all staged. Yeah, terrorists, governments, all this, it's all rubbish. A lot of it's rubbish. And I think, you know, it's all opportunities for us to fix it. I mean, it all comes back to the same thing, but it's the same everywhere. But that's the microcosm of the macrocosm. That's where we're all going if we don't pay attention. I mean, New Zealand will end up looking like the difference between Israel and Gaza. That's what it will end up. So will Australia, so will America, so will England, so will everywhere if we don't pay attention.
So do now people understand those pictures on the internet that you've seen holding those signs that say, we are all Palestinian?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much.
And we're all and like you say, we're all heading this way. Humanity's being undermined day by day, step by step, and every piece of rights or liberty that you currently possessed will simply cease to exist, and you'll be a slave in an apartheid-type system. It won't be a racial group controlling you. It'll be an oligarchy who determines who's good and who's bad, and categorize and chronicle every bit of communications you do. I remember Chris Green was talking about this on the show before MyMax, and everything that you text, even if you're trying to be cryptic about it, is still tracked and red flagged, and they can bring up your text message from 2004 that you said against the government or whatever, and use that as a basis to execute you. And people think that you and I, the people like us, are taking great risk by coming out and speaking publicly. Look, they're already looking at everything we're doing anyway. You know, what are you trying to safeguard? What do you think that they're not going to take off you? They'll take everything. Unless you speak out, unless you get the truth into the ears, and more importantly, into the hearts of people. Because it won't be people's minds that are getting changed by this. It'll be the real cost of human suffering that they see, and the emotional grab that the human spirit really has, that'll motivate people to do something, I believe.
Well, it will. And like, the whole system's bringing itself down by default. And again, it's mirrored by Gaza. It's all a macrocosm, you know. But it's all becoming so apparent now, and so people are waking up. But the problem is they're not really knowing what to do. You know, people are seeing, like I said here, that the electricity bills are suddenly going right up. So people are losing their homes, and you know, not being able to afford rentals. The price of rentals is ridiculous. You can't have a rental and pay the electricity bill. It's just absurd, you know. So they're really, really discarding a lot of the population. It's becoming really, really apparent. The more they do it, the more apparent it becomes. And there's the solution.
The question is, how apparent does it have to be? Does it have to be right in your face? Do you have to have an Israeli missile with "Made in the USA" tattooed on it land in your front yard before you'll do anything about it? Don't sit back. Move forward. The best defense is a good offense. We'll be right back at VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, hopefully, or you might be listening in other areas of the world on your own little computer screens and being tracked and traced. I'm so glad that you're willing to participate in the very heinous thought crime of listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show and any guests that we have on, pretty much. You know, sometimes you think about the bad stuff that's going on around you, and it's just too much. And, you know, you've got to just make jokes about these kind of things. Like Max, for instance, why are Israelis suspicious of chickpeas?
I don't know why, Vinny.
Because they could be working for Hamas. Which is incidentally why you don't take Israelis out for Turkish kebabs, because they'll shoot at the Hamas. And
very,
the other...
Very droll, mate, very droll.
Yeah, there's one more, which is a lot worse. What do Israeli tank crews say if they see a group of Palestinian children?
What?
Shalom!
Okay.
Now, see, the situation's not funny, you know, and I understand this. However, I do also comprehend that you can't take things seriously at all points during the whole time. I'm acting under the assumption that all these really cool Palestinian people that you were hanging out with and what have you, you were all laughing a lot of the time, yeah?
No, not really. No? Not laughing all the time. Just nice people, you know.
Never had a few laughs with them?
Oh, yeah, we had a few laughs, yeah. Yeah, we had a few laughs.
Okay, well, that's what I'm talking about, essentially. It's a coping mechanism, and I apologize if it seemed insensitive. It's just kind of that's the point here.
No, no, you're good, mate. No, we had a few laughs. I mean, a lot very intelligent people, very politically aware, but like I said, it was a real eye-opener because this is what's happening in all our countries. But like we were saying before the break, I mean, it's becoming really apparent now. And so that means it's breaking down. And even like we just talked about with what Israel's doing with building these 3,000 homes and withholding the tax money from Palestine, because they got, you know, the UN recognition, this, by their own actions, Israel is imploding because people are seeing what this state really is. I mean, the more Israel tries to protect itself, the more it implodes because it's not really under any threat. It's under an imaginary threat that it creates for itself, you know, because it's just, you know, it's just got to grab everything around it so that it can't get hurt, you know. It's just classic psychopathic mentality, the whole political structure of Israel, you know.
And so, so it's like stabbing yourself in the leg and then passing legislation to ban knives.
Well, yeah, I mean, this law of colonization, the way it's using colonization to just take over the rest of Palestine, this can only result in terrorism from the Arab sector being returned at Israel because of what it's done to them, and it can only result in the implosion and self-destruction of the state of Israel. You know, it was given a certain area, which wasn't particularly anyone to give it anyway, but there was an area set up in 1948 to be used as Israel. And they had that. They should have been happy with that. They didn't need to dispossess all the other people who actually lived there. And the dispossession of these people has created around about 5 million refugees that need to be allowed to return home. And you know, they've created a situation which is untenable, you know, by their own actions, that they've created the self-destruction of their own state. You know, it's something that they had given to them on a silver platter. They've turned it into a self-destructing mechanism that can't be stopped until they roll back all this colonization that they've been doing. And it's the same with the system overall when you look at it. I mean, the system has basically been colonizing us. It's turning us into commodities more and more and more in order to support this economic model. And so it's imploding because humanity created the economic model to service our needs. And now that it's becoming so oppressive and so in your face, and humanity is becoming so expendable within its parameters, it has to implode because it's untenable. It can't survive without us. And that's what's waking people up. So, yeah, bring it on.
Yeah, you shouldn't ever be afraid to lose what you've got in order to gain something more, I believe. You know, gambling, really. But what we're talking about here is essentially gambling with people's lives. Far, far more important a game and far greater risks involved. And we're talking about other people who gamble with other people's lives and don't have to pay the debt off. They just get a bailout, as it were.
Well, yeah, but I mean, this is something about the system, man. I mean, when I was in Peru, the connection that I got, I saw how ridiculous this whole thing is. I mean, it doesn't matter about the economic structure. It doesn't matter about any of it. What matters is the system itself, just its existence, you know, the existence of this civilization. What I experienced in Peru was an incredible connection, and I began to realize that even if we were to tear this system down and have mass arrests and put in an honest monetary system and all this sort of stuff, we've still got a system. And until we get that connection back with Earth and back with nature, we're going to still follow the parameters of the system. We need to get away from any type of system altogether. And I know that's a really hard, you know, thing for people to think about. But what I experienced was amazing. I began to see that we have the power individually and as a society to actually rein this system in as it is, in its current form. If we suddenly realize what our position in the social hierarchy is, that government are simply public trustees. I mean, I talk about this ad nauseum all the time, you know, in all the radio shows. I'm always talking about trust and government trustees and public trustees. That's what government is. Once we can realize this and we can rein this system back in and start looking at, you know, approaching it from a perspective of trust, realizing that everything these people do against us is a breach of trust, that's how we deal with it. Not acting within their legal parameters, but by stepping above that, putting it back into trust, then we can pull this system back into line and we can start putting it back on track so it should be going in the right direction. The first thing we need to do by setting it in the right direction is cancel all debt and take the interest off money, introduce an honest monetary system, number one. Number two, get all of the toxins out of the environment, all the fluoride out of the water, all the GM food, all of the toxins gone. Get them all out of everything, even out of the medications that we use. Out of all of this stuff, we need to go back to natural remedies, go back to natural food, go back to a natural environment. If we do that, over a period of about three generations, we will start becoming active again. It'll probably take about 50 or 60 years to get all the toxins out of the environment, you know, to a point that we're becoming active again, you know. But once we do that, you'll find that people wake up to their connection with nature by default. You don't have to change their thinking. You don't have to change their paradigm. You won't have to fix the system because the system will dissolve by itself simply because of its own unnecessary nature, because we'll realize it's unnecessary as we become more active once we get all of these toxins out of our environment. We have the power to rein this system in. As we are right now, we don't need any revolution or anything. All we need to do is change our perspective of what our relationship with politicians is. That's all we have to do. Unite the community so we can talk to these people and say, hey, you guys are in breach of trust. We're not going this way anymore. Guess what? We've realized that we're mankind and you're our employees and we're not doing it your way anymore. We don't want to because you're messing the planet up. Have a look at the place. We're not doing it anymore. It's that simple. We can do this, Vinny. I really believe we can. And we've been given the opportunity to do it because it's become so apparent. See, the gecko agrees with me. I've got these geckos here. They chirp in whenever I say something really profound. So
you're just like, yeah, you're onto it, Max.
It's great. It's great. I love the geckos, mate.
Yeah, yeah. There's a bird in New Zealand called a poo gecko. What do you call a bird that's half lizard? A poo gecko. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. But no, we have the opportunity to do this, mate, and I think we can do it. And I think the fact that the system is becoming so apparent, it's like the Israeli situation. The system is imploding. It's self-destructing through its own need to make itself more efficient. It's making itself more apparent. And people are waking up to the power that we have, and that's all we really have to do.
Well, it's kind of like you see a bully get really, really scared of his mum or something, and then you realize, hey, this guy can be intimidated. And I've previously thought him to be really intimidating and I was afraid of him, but I realize now that he's afraid of something. The power structure. There's somebody behind somebody who's in front of you all the time, and somebody who's more powerful, something that they fear. You find out what it is, and ultimately, it's public awareness. That's why the media game is now so important in the new media, is to get these things into the public domain before it's too late, before they shut things down. And even when they do shut things down, I'll be probably in some deep backwoods carbon copy print press like in Soviet times or something like that. Information always gets out. You can't stop it. And I think that they're deathly afraid of everything that we now know about them. We know their weaknesses, we know their game plans, we know their end game, we know it all. And they're very, very frightened about what we'll do about it, because knowledge is power, and they've tried to keep a stranglehold over all of it for so long that they don't know what's going to happen once other people wield the knowledge, once other people wield that power. And I fear, though, that we may accumulate so much knowledge and so much power that it will corrupt us. And the best way to avert that is to not keep it to yourself, but to share what you know, to share what you experience with other people, to pass it on, to share that power, essentially. Because the real problem with this society, ultimately, at the end of the day, is that power, accountability, responsibility, and freedom is not being shared equitably. And that is not freedom. That is not a future that anybody wants. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. My very special guest, Max Egan, and I will be right back for the second hour after the break. Welcome back. Okay, now it is hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. There's a bit of a problem with the feed there, everybody, and I apologise about that, but I think we're back now with my very special guest, Max Egan. So let's move on from the Gaza situation. I wanted to discuss some of the other aspects of your trips. And I was supposed to meet you at Auckland Airport, and I was trying to get a message through the kind of switchboard there or whatever. But no, you're not allowed to pass messages back and forth between passengers or anything like that. I didn't have your cell phone. I'm not sure if you had mine. It was just an awful kerfuffle. So I drove all the way out to the airport, took 45 minutes to get out there, waited around for about an hour trying this, that, and the other, and then having to drive all the way back. And I was really sorry I didn't get to meet you in person, mate, on your way out through to Peru.
Yeah, sorry about that. I was really rushed as well. Got there, the plane was late and blah, blah, blah. And we had to run through and check our luggage because our luggage wasn't going through to Peru, and it was just a major, major drama. So, yeah, that was fun. And it was interesting, actually. It was quite a comical security guard at Auckland Airport. I came through with my laptop, my MacBook, and my MacBook has got a sticker on it in big letters. It says question authority, and I put it through the customs thing, and there's this big customs guy, and he's looked at me and he's looked at the laptop and he's picked up this rubber glove and he's put it on his hand and he said, just because you've got that written on your computer, he started putting this rubber glove on his hand, and I just looked at him and he just smiled and said, just kidding, mate. And let me go through. So that was an interesting moment.
Thank you very much for mock threatening to put your hands up my japsai.
Yeah, yeah, that was love. That was New Zealand. Yeah. that's my biggest memory of New Zealand Airport was the threat of the rubber glove. So welcome to New Zealand.
Hey, I think that could be done as perhaps a introduction song for the what's it called, the TSA. Welcome to America.
yeah, that would be good. That'd be good. That'd be a good chorus.
Mm-mm-mm.
I didn't go through America. I was offered to go. I almost did. I almost went to LA and through to Hawaii, but I just didn't want to deal with the whole American TSA thing. Even when I was in Europe, I mean, and you had to be at an airport, say, you know, 2 hours before, which is ridiculous, but you've got to be there 2 hours before for an international flight. If you're flying to America, you had to be there 3 hours before because there's an extra hour of security screening. Even at an international airport, even in Europe, there's an extra hour of screening at the airport in order for you to board a flight to America. And then when you get there, you got to deal with the TSA when you get there. So I just thought, no, I don't really have time to go to America, you know, just in the amount of screening. I mean, it uses up half of your holiday.
just chilling out in Guantanamo with your luggage, you know, like Tom Hanks in Terminal.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like that. Yeah, yeah, it would be. Yeah.
Yeah. Come to America. It's like visiting Krakosia.
Yeah, I just didn't want to bother. But I mean, I might be going to Hawaii in the new year. There's a plan for a new project in the new year that will encompass quite a lot of travel. It's called. Well, it's going to be called Full Circle. So
Yeah, let's hope that the TSA doesn't try and, fiddle with your Waikiki or put its hands up your Honolulu.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's only Hawaii, so hopefully it won't be that bad in Hawaii. But only going to be there for a little while. But then there's a whole trip that's going on after that. It'll end up back in Peru. And I'll hook up with a lot of people. A lot of the people that I made connections with on the trip, actually. Like Rick Simpson. I spent a lot of time with Rick Simpson in Croatia and in Slovenia. And he's going to come down to South America. We're all going to converge on South America next year. Hopefully Ben Stewart will be coming down as well. And a couple of other people. And Ken O'Keefe will be with me as well. So there'll be a number of us down there in Peru, and we're going to make a documentary about the whole journey. And we've got a whole mission actually planned for next year. That's just part of it. The whole Peru trip's just part of it. It goes way back through Europe as well, and we'll probably end up back in Palestine. So, and again, just to touch on Palestine again, I'm actually even thinking late next year, I'll probably go there and hopefully stay there for about 6 months and broadcast from there. So that'll be interesting as well. But yeah, so next year, got some big plans for next year. That's all come from the trip that I just made. It was kind of weird. I went to all these places and kind of just followed synchronicity. I didn't really know where I was going when I left there. I had vague plans, but it was all sorts of stuff was put on the table. And I just kind of went with what worked and went to all these places I didn't really expect to go, and ended up coming home wondering what it was kind of all about. And then it all just fell into place, and this whole trip just kind of unfolded for next year. So it's pretty exciting. And hey, here we are, mate, 2012, December 2012. What do you think? What's going to happen? Is the world going to end in a couple of weeks, you reckon, or what? What's going to go on, mate? What's your take on the whole thing?
If it's going to end, at least I'll be having my December 21st party on that night. And if you listen to this broadcast, you're invited. You can go hit me 14. Up on Facebook or send me an email or something like that if you want to come around. And we're gonna party like it's the end of the world. What would you rather do? Yeah, absolutely. And it'll be a Friday night.
Well, it depends. Is it 14 days or 15 days? Is it the Southern Hemisphere time or the Northern Hemisphere time?
Well, who gives a frack? It'll be the Southern Hemisphere time. So by the time I'm partying up on Friday night, everybody else will still be at work on Thursday evening in the Northern Hemisphere, and the world will have already ended by the time you guys get to see it,
Yeah, I wonder.
Here's the thing. If the world is going to end, does it end on Southern Hemisphere time or Northern Hemisphere time? Is it the first light that comes to New Zealand when it becomes December 21st officially? Is that when everything instantly turns into yellow custard? Or is the universe a lot more centric in nature and it wants to do it December 21st Eastern Standard Time so that all the New Yorkers are the ones who get to party the end of the world thing when it happens?
Exactly. That's what I was saying. I mean, I'm wondering whether the Mayan calendar sort of honors the international date line as we see it to be, which actually isn't exactly straight anyway. It's a kind of a weird line. It kind of zigzags and curves and goes around all these weird places. So that's kind of weird in itself. But I'm just wondering whether it does. I mean, I don't think it'll be the end of the world, but even if it's a rising consciousness, I'm wondering where the international date line fits into it. So yeah, so I wonder when it's going to happen, mate. But I wonder what it's all about. It's interesting that we're here in this moment, in this month, and we're hearing surprisingly little about it from everything. I mean, last year, they were releasing films, and they're talking about Doomsday and all sorts of stuff. Everyone was in fear of the coming December 21st date to be, 2012 date that was only 1 year away. And now here we are 14 days away, and everyone's...
You know what I reckon? The New World Order wants everybody to calmly transition themselves into a freedomless, loving society. It's a lot more difficult to do that if people are afraid of the end of the world and don't care about the authorities and what they say anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to see the amount of progress that the police state has actually made in the last 12 months while everyone's been waiting for this date to come along and save them.
There's another thing. Incidentally, Max, the 21st of December is the last day of bank trading for the year. And the 23rd of December, 3 days afterwards, you know, is the day that the Federal Reserve Act can be renewed on Christmas Eve, when no doubt very few politicians will actually be in the House of Representatives to vote on it. And so just like when the original Federal Reserve Act was passed at around the same time, 100 years ago or so,
well,
they're going to just slip it under everybody's nose again.
Well, wasn't that a 99-year charter, the Federal Reserve? Didn't they do it? Doesn't it run out on December 21st, 2012?
It runs out on the December 21st by default because it's the last day of bank trading, because it hits on the Friday, and the official renewal is on the following Monday, which is Christmas Eve.
Okay. Well, there you go. Interesting.
How many people are going to be watching C-SPAN on Christmas Eve to see if the Federal Reserve Act is going to be reinstated? This is what they always do, man. All the worst draconian legislation always gets passed over Christmas time. It's just incidentally when they're talking about the end of the world, and maybe that's distracting all of us and what have you. We're forgetting those very important facts that they're planning to destroy the world by any means necessary, and this is one of them.
Well, it's not that they're planning to destroy it. I mean, I think they're just planning to change it into what they want, something more efficient.
Which would, in my opinion, destroy it.
Well,
everything of value, really.
Well, it will. It'll change all life on the planet. I mean, the whole transhumanist agenda is designed to change all life. And that's something else why I think why I want to do this trip next year and encompass Peru in this trip is because the need to preserve this shamanistic knowledge, this shamanistic tradition, the knowledge of the plants, the plant medicines, the access to those realms, because if we lose that information, I don't think we'll get it back. I don't think there'll be any way for consciousness to go in that direction again. And it's within that information and how to use these plants and the knowledge of the plants and how to get that connection back to the earth that our salvation lies. That's what I mean. No matter, even if we bring this system down and put in a new one that's more efficient and fairer and all this sort of stuff, it's still a system. It's still not who we are. We don't need a system, because what I experienced in that connection was profound. What we could be if we had all of our higher senses online, if we had the instincts that all the other creatures on earth have got, which we should have, which we don't have because of the shutdown state of our biology, you know, the shutdown state of our pineal gland, our endocrine system, everything. It's all shut down, you know, and we can get back to that. And that's where we need to go. And we're only really going to be able to see that because of the predicament that we're in. You know, we need these medicine men. We need the shaman to show us this world. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, everybody should take ayahuasca and all this sort of stuff. I mean, you've got access to these realms anyway if you get all the toxins out of your system. And these shaman, these ayahuasca experiences that people go to have, when you were sick back in the old days, you would go to see the shaman and he would take the ayahuasca. You wouldn't, he would. And he would talk to the plant realms and he would find out what was wrong with you energetically, and he'd be able to communicate the information to you so you could make adjustments in your life, maybe consume certain plants that had volunteered to be medicine for you and all this sort of stuff. This is how reality worked and how people used to communicate with reality. And it sounds like all mumbo jumbo. How can some plant volunteer to be a medicine for you? You know, but if you can enter those realms where you can communicate with the plants, which you can, through tryptophan, which is in everything, and DMT is the, tryptophan's the antenna, DMT is the interface. If you had more DMT active in your body, you'd be able to communicate with the tryptophan that exists in all living things, and you'd be able to communicate with reality through higher senses. This is how it works. And
so
this
have
is
you
what
spoken, these, have you spoken with a plant? Well,
what happened when I was in the Amazon, There was a certain section of a ceremony where I was lying there and the shaman was singing, and there, it was like the Amazon jungle itself told me its entire emotional journey. And it's not anything I could even convey to you in words. It kind of downloaded its entire emotional journey into me, and I saw the connection that I could have and that I'm supposed to have with reality, with the mother, with the earth. What we are supposed to be. All of my higher senses came online, and I was sitting in this room. I was communicating with the spirit realm, and I was communicating with the jungle and the earth itself. and it was telling me its emotional journey. And I felt the whole thing, you know. And so I could see what we are actually supposed to be. And civilization itself is completely alien to human consciousness. It doesn't make sense that we would have come up with something as environmentally unfriendly as civilization, because we need the environment to function. We are one with this earth. The earth and us are so connected, we can't survive without it. Without it, we're just floating through space. It's not a good look. It's not a good environment. You can't just float through space. You need the earth, you know. So why would we think it's just a resource? It's not a resource. It's our home. It's who we are. We're supposed to be custodians of this planet. We're supposed to be acting in harmony with this planet the way all other life on this planet is. Why is our existence so detrimental to our existence? Because of the damage we do to our home. You know what I'm saying? We're killing ourselves by killing our source of life, which is the earth. This is who we are. So we're killing it with civilization. So where does civilization come from? It seems alien to human consciousness. Everything, even when you go to school and they teach you what are the basic shapes, they teach you it's a square, it's a cube, it's a triangle, it's a circle. Well, these aren't basic shapes. These are man-made constructs. Basic shapes are spirals and waves. You know, that's basic shapes. Branches and spirals and waves, that's basic shapes. Nature are basic shapes. Everything we create is unnatural. And then you start looking at things such as the Gnostic teachings, and you wonder whether there's any credit to that. When they start talking about the Archon mind and the Archons, how the Archons can't innovate, they can only imitate. And you start wondering whether there's credence in some of this sort of stuff. You know, what is it that's taken over our mind and caused us to create this thing that we call civilization, the sole purpose of which seems to be to disconnect us from nature and disconnect us from who we are, you know?
In other words, what's the point of having a civilization if we're not going to be civilized?
Well, we're not civilized at all. And the thing I got, though, is that we wouldn't need it. If we were living in perfect harmony with this planet, we wouldn't need civilization. And that's what I mean. If we can find a way now of reining this system in and putting out public trustees in a positions of administrationship, which is all we need them to do, is administrate our infrastructure, because we need it, because we've got this hideous social system we've created. So we need something to control the infrastructure for now. But the first thing we've got to do is get everybody out of fear. So you've got to cancel all debt. It's all fiction. We don't need it. We don't need to run our lives on an economic model. And, you know, that's the first step anyway.
Yeah. How did we get into all this debt? Well, they just made it up. What do you mean? They pretended that it exists, so therefore we're in debt? Yeah. Well, why don't we just pretend that it doesn't exist? You know, it's pretty simple. Have you ever noticed the most complicated problems always have the simplest solution, as opposed to a problem reaction solution? We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the breed of uranium in the mortar? What you know about AIPAC controlling the reporter?
What's Welcome back. The world? People kill people that other people commit. Ladies and gentlemen, you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio.com worldwide. Oh, yeah. It's my very special guest, Max Egan. He was talking about over the break about how I wanted to kind of set up parallel institutions, you know, institutions that teach people that they don't need the institution and that they don't want it, so that by the time they've grown up and grown strong enough, they can leave the institution and never have use of it again. And eventually, once everybody's gone through it, the institution itself will die off. Like a helpful parasite, in other words, that dies after it's given you something good rather than dies after it's taken everything good from you.
Yeah, well, that'd be good. That'd be good.
Like, I
mean, we could do that with the system that we've got. I mean, that's what I mean. We can rein this in by looking at it as a trust agreement, rein it all back in and put it back on track. And people will be connected by default. Once we do that, we'll realize the pure unnecessary nature of the system. You know, we don't need to base our lives on an economic model. It doesn't make sense for us to do that. You know, we're sacrificing everything in order to support something that's fiction. We're sacrificing everything real in order to support numbers on a screen that don't mean anything. We let these numbers rule our lives, you know, by how much wealth we've got, how much we can buy, in the belief that we own this stuff. But we don't really own anything. I mean, we're only here for a little while. We're only here for, you know, 60 or 100 years or something. So you don't really own anything. The Earth's here for millions of years after you're gone. You're just here for a little while. You're just a caretaker. And, you know, we're doing a damn awful job. I think we can rein this system in, and we can restructure this education system, restructure this health system, get it so it is actually a health system rather than a health prevention system. You know, the World Health Organization seems to control world health by making sure people don't have any, you know. And so then it can sell them pharmaceutical drugs. I mean, it's everything they do, they create a system to control something, you know. It's not to make sure you've got health, it's to make sure you don't have health. You know, the world, the FDA, the Food and Drug Association, is to make sure all the food's crap and that everybody's drugged, basically. I mean, that's what they do. It's ridiculous. You know, they tell you really what they do by the name of the organization, but it's always the opposite of what they actually present it as.
Yeah, well, and the solution is very simple. Make all those lies the reality.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Yeah. Well, it would, you know, but we could put this system back on track, and over a short period we'd find that people would start to, you know, become whole again and become more active again. And by active, I mean have their higher senses more active. And it wouldn't be so dulled down because, you know, the world's pretty dulled down. Or the more westernized people get, the more dulled down they become anyway, because the more toxins they get introduced into their system.
Well, hey, that was something I found funny, Max. You know how a lot of people are saying, oh, there's too many people in Asia and blah, 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 and the white race is being exterminated, our semen count has gone down. And actually, that's the result of having all this extra technology and EMF radiation and the fluoride in your water and all of that kind of stuff. If you don't want the population to be growing, mate, don't worry. It ain't. Western culture is like 1.2 birth rate when, in order to prevent its own extinction, needs to be at least 2.6. You know, and the rest of the world, hey, look, as soon as they get developed, they'll become just as sterile and unfertile as the rest of us. So why don't you develop the undeveloped world and quit worrying about the people and how many there are of them? Because sure enough, the population will stabilize and you won't have to worry about it. The difficulty is all the resources that we're using aren't renewable. You know, there's no possibility that you can maintain that many people using the current stuff that is being forced on us today. There's plenty of other decent technologies out there that have been suppressed. You know, even the vaporizing carburetor, some dude like Cameron Pogue or whatever in the 1930s invented this little carburetor, got 200 miles a gallon by vaporizing the fuel instead of just burning the liquid gas, you know. This kind of stuff is out there and has been for a very long time. We're not using what's available to us. That's why people think stuff is so bad and can't be corrected, because they're not aware of the things that have already been invented to correct them.
Yeah, well, absolutely. There's all sorts of hidden technology, but even with the technology that we're using every day, even with the computers that we use and everyday items that we use, they could actually build these things to last, so that we only actually had to buy them once. You know, and if they broke down at all, then it was a simple task to repair them. You know, I mean, they could do things this way, but everything's made to be disposable and break down in order to support an economic model. It all comes back to economics. It's all about supporting these numbers on the screen. We have to have permanent growth. And if you've got permanent growth, then you've got to make everything disposable so you can keep making it, which means you've got to keep strip mining the earth and stripping of it all its resources in order to support this permanent growth model. It's unsustainable. And all it can do is result in the destruction of all life on the planet in order to support a fictional economic system. That's what I'm saying. You've got to get rid of this whole fictional economic system. It's not about that. You know, what is real wealth? It isn't money. Wealth is life. That's what wealth is. Wealth is
quality.
Life, physical health, and quality. Yeah, quality of life. Freedom to be all that you can be. Freedom to express yourself in the way that is unique to Vinnie Eastwood. That's what freedom is, and that's what wealth is. Freedom to be all that you could possibly be. And as long as it doesn't affect anybody else's ability to be all that they can possibly be. you know, and treat everybody as an equal and see that everybody's perspective is valid. I mean, that's wealth, to live in a society like that. It isn't physical wealth. It isn't the latest car that looks better than the guy next door's car. It isn't any of that stuff. You know, but we've been trained to think that it is, and it's all about supporting this economic model so everything we make is disposable. Even our housing is temporary accommodation. We don't build anything that'll last. There isn't a house here now that will still be there in 100 years from now. It'll all be pulled down. All the stuff that we've built recently, none of this lasts. You know, back in the old days, they used to build castles and they used to use, go to Europe and you'll find houses and villages that are hundreds of years old. But in our Western societies, in American society, Australian society, New Zealand society, it's all prefab gyprock stuff that's made to be thrown away, torn down 50 to 100 years from now and rebuilt again in order to support an economic model.
I've got a mate down the way in New Zealand. He makes earthquake-proof housing panels out of plastic, and it floats. So it doesn't matter whether you're hit by an earthquake, doesn't matter whether or not you're hit by a tsunami, doesn't matter how much weather or degrading or anything that you throw at it, there's your building material.
Yeah, that works, and there it'll just float away and still stay solid as a house. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be cool. You know, you could lash a whole bunch of them together and have a little atoll like on Waterworld.
Floating village. Create your own country made out of plastic.
I mean, and this is another important concept, colonizing the sea.
Yeah, well,
there's a lot more surface area of ocean than there is of humans. The difficulty is disposing of your waste at sea is just going to pollute all the environment for basically anybody that is around the currents of the ocean, which is what, at the moment, 90% of the population lives on coastal areas?
Well, there's a lot of waste floating around out in the ocean anyway that people don't see. It's not in the shipping lanes, but a lot of what people pump out into the ocean, there's you know, islands of garbage out in the ocean that aren't on the shipping lanes that people don't see, but they are reported to exist.
Oh, they're not. There's not just these massive islands. I thought I heard of an island of garbage that was 50 kilometres across or something floating around somewhere. And the rest of it is this sort of half-broken down plastic that doesn't break down. It just gets broken up and it turns into this sort of fine particulate soup, and all the fish and seabirds and all of this kind of stuff, and you cut them open and they're all full of this plastic crap that's stuck in their gullet that they can't digest. And apparently huge tracts of the ocean, I believe, off the coast of the east coast of the United States is a huge one there. And in the North Pacific between California and Japan, there's a big one there. And also down the Horn of Africa, these massive, giant, thousands of miles across areas of ocean where you can just drain a net in the sea and come up with a handful of plastic particulates. It's extraordinary. And some people have even seen this as a resource and are, in fact, scooping up and harvesting this this old plastic and making vacuum cleaners out of it.
Oh, my God. We've really done a wonderful job, haven't we?
I mean, it's human creativity's ability to turn a negative into a positive, isn't it? Oh, my God, the oceans are completely destroyed, and there's all the fish stocks are being depleted, and the radiation's coming down from space, and we're all getting more skin cancer, and there's chemtrails all over the place. Hey, we can make vacuum cleaners out of garbage.
Yeah, there you go. We can make vacuum cleaners and vacuum it all up. It's all good.
It's kind of a nice ironic use for it, don't you think?
Well, at least someone's found a use for it. I mean, that's one thing, you know. But, I mean, we are doing an enormous amount of damage, and I think it's about time we paid attention. And that's why I keep going on about trust, because I think that's the remedy. You know, once we pay attention, I mean, we realise that, you know, all the governments that are doing this, all the pollution, all this stuff that's happening, all the problems that we see around the place, whether it's through corporate corruption, corporate dumping in the ocean and all this sort of stuff, it's all ultimately because those people we elect as our trustees turn a blind eye or create legislation that allows this practice to legally be carried out. You know, so they're all in breach of trust because that's not what we employ them to do. When they take office, they swear to serve us, the people. And that's what we employ them to do. They are public trustees. But we have to have a united community so we can stand up and say, hey, enough is enough. You know, we've got to realise that the governments are the ones who've created this whole situation. They're not going to be the ones that are going to turn it around. It has to be we, the people, that turn it around. We have to notice that there's a problem, and we have to be prepared to put down our barriers with each other and stand together and stand up strongly enough to address this problem. You know, if we don't, what sort of a future are we allowing for our kids, you know?
Are you sure it's we, the people? Because I'm starting to think more and more that it's me, the person, that has to stand up, regardless of whether or not there's anybody else around me.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I'm doing, and that's what you're doing. I mean, that's what I mean, though, you know. But we need more people to be doing it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, but I can do it because I don't have a problem with anyone. And you don't either. I mean, I don't have anybody that I wouldn't invite into my house. I don't have a problem with anybody. I don't have bad vibes about anybody that I know, anybody that I've met, or anybody. I just care about the future. I respect all people. And it's as simple as that. And because I respect all people, and because I care about the future, and because I care about my son, I care about myself, and I believe in my right to be able to express my opinion, then I believe I will. And I believe also that it's my duty to do so, because I'm a caretaker of this planet. We're all caretakers. Every generation is the caretakers of this planet. We are the custodians of this planet, the custodians of life on this planet for future generations. And as a good custodian, when you see something terribly, terribly wrong, it really is your duty to stand up and say something about it. And if your heart's in the right space, well, it becomes a need, not just a duty, but a need to do it. And so that's what I do, you know.
And certain people are more adept at being custodians. In New Zealand, I think there's several thousand rivers, and all the rivers that are currently under government protection and government run to keep them clean and everything are polluted up to what do fracking do. And about 1,000 rivers and lakes were given to Māori groups to be caretakers of the land, and 100% of them are pristine to this day. What does that tell you about the intention of the government versus the capacity of Indigenous people to take care of the country versus somebody you elect rather than somebody who's just kind of naturally born to it, I guess?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, they're all in breach of trust. You see, that's what these governments do. That's what I'm saying. All these pollutions and all the problems that we face everywhere, these big mountains of garbage, all this plastic in the ocean, ultimately it all comes down to governments, public trustees, creating legislation which allows corporations to do these things and turning a blind eye themselves. So, you know, that's a breach of trust. So that's why, you know, the individual themselves has to stand up and call them on breach of trust. Realize what your relationship with government is. Every single person in New Zealand, every single person in Australia, everywhere, in every country, realize what your relationship with these people is and stand up and call them on it. Because that's the only way we're going to fix the problem. And the people have got to take responsibility for this. We each have to individually take responsibility. Realize that if we're turning a blind eye to this, then we're part of the problem. We really are. You've got to speak out about it, but you've got to do it from the right perspective, because we still can turn things around. But if we just think it's too hard and we don't have any power and, oh, I'm just a little individual, just little old me who can't do anything, well, we've already lost. You know, it's time. That's what I think this whole 2012 moment is, this whole enlightenment that's happening. It's people waking up to the power that they have and participating in the shift. There can be a shift, but you have to participate in it. People aren't willing to participate in reality. That's the problem.
Yeah, well, I think there's so many different ways to distract you from reality, from drugs to TV to video games. People kind of lose touch with it, I guess. You know, it'd be really funny. I had this concept yesterday. If every single time a politician who was a scumbag was walking around or anything, everybody would be really disrespectful to him. You know, like he'd go in and park his car at a grocery store to go in and get a Snickers bar, and when he comes back, somebody'd spray painted his wheels or something. You'll listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's all about accountability. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the final segment of the Vinnie Eastwood Show today. My very special guest, Max Egan, and I wanted to give out a few announcements. Tomorrow, if you're in New Zealand, about 2 p.m. when this show finishes down at Altair Square in the centre of Auckland City, there is a protest being held against the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, otherwise known as the TPPA, which is, in my opinion, one of the most detrimental things that you could ever protest against in your entire life. And if you are knocked down there, God help you. There are Facebook events and all of this kind of stuff around there. We're going to march on Sky City. All of these scumbag politicians and hundreds of delegates from all over the world will be there. I will be there. I have a new GoPro camera thingy, and as well as my other one for capturing the good audio, and a 100-watt megaphone, and my John Key not wanted posters and banners and all that kind of stuff. I will be there exposing scumbaggery, and if anybody wants to give me a hand or drive me down there or drive my car in the protest and that kind of thing, be very much obliged. Get in touch with me, gorillamrnews@gmail.com, or go to the contact page of the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. We'll most likely be playing a replay of a show tomorrow because I want to be down there early to set up and expose a bit more scumbaggery if I can. Right, that's out of the way. Max, final segment. What's something that is so important for you right now that you kind of don't really get the chance to say? Anything spring to mind?
Well, look, I'd like to say that I think that that little protest you just talked about is very important. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is absolutely shocking. This is basically the creation of the Asian Union, basically. This is what it's leading to, the way we've got the European Union and what that's done to Europe. What they want to do is they want to combine Australia, New Zealand and Asia into one economy, basically. And that's what this agreement is leaning towards. So I think that's a very important issue that you just brought up. And people need to get the word out to people. Everybody in Australia and New Zealand needs to know about this. So, yeah, I'd say that's a really good thing to go and support. So I just want to offer my total support for that little protest that you're having. They're actually having a meeting there about it or something, are they?
Yeah, they're doing these negotiations that have been going on all week.
Yeah, okay, well, fair enough. So it's happening there this year. Well, yeah, get out there and make some noise about that. I mean, I wish I'd known that was on. I would have mentioned it as well. But good on you, good on you. Now, the most important thing in my life in the moment is preparing for this this journey next year, which, as I said, is going to encompass a lot of places and ultimately probably culminate back in Gaza. And that's going to join up with the Trade Not Aid mission of Ken O'Keefe's eventually. And that's a huge journey I've got planned, probably starting around about February and going to around about July or August. And so that's really, really big on my plate at the moment. Going back on air again, I went back on air last week. I'm doing a show tomorrow. And you know, just doing that up until at least February. Then I'm going to try, even when I go back away again, I'm going to try to keep the shows up while I'm away. And I've got a huge website production we want to put together. We want to create video logs and interactive chat applets and all sorts of stuff so people can kind of accompany us on this journey that we're putting together. And it's going to encompass shamanism and Europeanism and the whole lot and bring it all back through to try to link up as much of it as we can and basically show people how the whole world's really, really connected. And back to shamanism as well, I really want to work on bringing an understanding to people of a need to preserve the shamanistic culture because we really do. One of the things that controls us so much is a system that's been put in place by the Crown Corporation. You know, the whole Crown system that came out of the Vatican, you know, the Unum Sanctum Trust and all this sort of stuff that Pope Bonifaci created back in 1302. The biggest threat to this whole corporate system was shamanistic tradition, paganism, pantheism. That's why the church went to so much trouble to stamp out all of these traditions. And the fact that they went to so much trouble should indicate to people what a real need there is to preserve these traditions and look into these traditions, because they went to so much trouble to stamp them out, because these are actually the biggest threat that the system faces. If we regain that knowledge and regain that connection to the earth that we're supposed to have, the whole system comes down. And it comes down in such a way that we won't need any system at all. And that might be really, really hard for people to comprehend. But that's only because they're really, really locked down, whether they believe it or not. They're only experiencing a very small bandwidth of reality. All of their higher senses are shut down, and they're only thinking with half their brain. But we can get this back to how we should be. And so I think there's a real need to preserve these traditions, and that's what I'm working towards next year, that and other things. So that's pretty big and important in my life at the moment.
And what's important for me, just for right now, is in fact doing a drive for donations and subscriptions, to put it bluntly. Christmas season, and you wake up and your bank accounts are dry and that kind of thing, and you're like, oh my God, there's only really one way I can bring myself out of this, and this is with the people who listen to the show and absorb this content and get to listen to people like Max and myself on a daily basis. You're essentially the most important financial group in the world today, because you know how the finance system actually works a hell of a lot better than most people. And so if you can donate in any way, shape, or form, just go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. There's a little donate link there, as well as you could subscribe for $5, $10, or $20 a month, whatever you can afford, just in order to keep me on the air and paying the internet bills, paying the rent, and all of that kind of stuff. Just basically, all I want is enough to survive on so that I can just keep doing what I'm doing. A lot of people say to us, Max, keep up the good work. And now's the chance to help out and make sure we can. And if do you take donations as well, Max?
Yeah, I take donations. It's great when people can donate. Few and far between at the moment because, yeah, things are pretty tight for everybody, but that's just the way it goes. But, yeah, it's a huge help when people can do it.
Mm. Yeah. I've also got the idea as well that getting out there into the protest scenes a little bit more, because I've been on the radio show heaps and not really quite so much on the streets anymore or ambushing scumbags. I've got to get a heck of a lot more back into that. I just received a donation earlier by my man Greg. He sorted me out with a new GoPro camera. So that's going to be handy for use in extreme protesting. I'm going to turn it into kind of like adventure protesting, you know?
Yeah, good stuff. You can actually use them to live stream as well. They've got a Wi-Fi connection. If you've got a little modem, if you've got to set your phone up as a modem, you should be able to hook up through your phone and live stream to Ustream or to YouTube even, so that even if they close you down, it's already up there. It's already up there on YouTube. It's already done, you know. So that's a thought. That's a very, very useful activist tool, to be able to live stream any situation. And they come with straps so you can hook onto a helmet or onto a hat or onto your belt or whatever. So, yeah, go for it, Vinny.
Well, I've got a shoulder mount which extends a little arm out in front of me so that it's hands-free, and I've got the GoPro mounted on the end of it, so it's like looking at me, and I can capture myself doing the megaphoning and all of that sort of stuff without having to use any hands to use the camera sort of thing. So I use technology in whatever way I can to get what I want out of it, and what I want is to capture dialogue, protesting, great visuals, so we can put it up on YouTube for people to see, so that there's actually some kind of a public record of what really goes on, preferably in high qualities, because, you know, we're not just messing around here. The ability that technology grants us is far more powerful than a lot of people realize, and most times people just stop themselves from using anything or doing anything because they fear that it's not good enough. And I'll tell you what, if you're doing anything, it's good enough.
Absolutely, mate. You've got to be speaking out, and that sort of stuff is great. And the live stream ability of those cameras makes them a really, really useful tool. So, that's a really good thing to do. But again, you know, it's good to go out and show solidarity in these protests. But again, not to get violent and not to get involved in all that sort of stuff, because it's what they want, you know. It's only really good for solidarity. What we need is trust. We need people to understand what the solution is, which is to look at it from a perspective of trust That's what governments are. They're just public trustees. And once we have enough people that understand this, as soon as people like you or I start standing up and calling it on it, we'll have enough public opinion behind us that we can affect some really, really positive change. So it's really good to get that perspective in people's minds to help them understand that their relationship with government is that of trusteeship, you know. So that's where the solution lies, I think. And that's what protests can be really good to do. Spread this type of information around. Make sure you get everything that you can on video. Get it uploaded because, you know, we are the media now. The real media doesn't work anymore. It's completely dysfunctional. The alternate media is the real media now. And the media, the mainstream media, knows that. They know they're losing the information war. And we've got to keep at it. You know, we can't shirk now. It's a really important time. And I think it's a great time, mate. We are making a difference and the wheels are falling off. They have to because the system is unsustainable. It has to implode by its own means. It just will because, you know, that's just the way it's designed. It's flawed.
Mm. The Waikato Times reporter, award-winning, Alistair Bone came around to the house and interviewed me the other day. He admitted to me in email that the mainstream media is trying to do what I'm doing, but they're failing miserably and I'm blitzing all of them. Just by getting the support of the people, by giving the people what they want, which is reality, real information. It's so much more exciting than fluff.
It is, mate. Good on you, Vinny.
All right. You can check out Max Egan's website at thecrowhouse.com and send him some donations if you can for this Christmas season. Allow him to buy a nice Christmas tree with some fluffy lights so that he can hang his geckos on or something like that. And of course, I'm always really, really pushing for donations right now. Need a couple of grand to take it through this month and on to the next month comfortably. So please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and donate today to keep me on air and keep me doing what I'm doing. We'll see you again sometime, folks.